enormous mass and hence gravitational pull. Recently, by carefully analyzing the photographs of the Hubble Space Telescope with a computer, scientists were able to construct maps of the distribution of dark matter throughout the universe. A fierce scramble has been going on to find out what dark matter is made of. Some scientists think it might consist of ordinary matter, except that it is very dim, that is, made of brown dwarf stars, neutron stars, black holes, and so on, which are nearly invisible. Such objects are lumped together as baryonic matter, that is, matter made of familiar baryons, like neutrons and protons. Collectively, they are called MACHOs, short for Massive Compact Halo Objects. Others think dark matter may consist of very hot non-baryonic matter, such as neutrinos, called hot dark matter. However, neutrinos move so fast that they cannot account for most of the clumping of dark matter and galaxies that we see in nature. Still others throw up their hands and think that dark matter was made of an entirely new type of matter called cold dark matter, or WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, which are the leading candidate to explain most of dark matter. COBE satellite. Using an ordinary telescope, the workhorse of astronomy since the time of Galileo, one cannot possibly solve the mystery of dark matter. Astronomy has progressed remarkably far by using standard earthbound optics. However, in the 1990s, a new generation of astronomical instruments was coming of age that used the latest in satellite technology, lasers, and computers, and completely changed the face of cosmology. One of the first fruits of this harvest was the COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer, satellite, launched in November 1989. While the original work of Penzias and Wilson confirmed just a few data points consistent with the Big Bang, the COBE satellite was able to measure scores of data points that matched precisely the prediction of black body radiation made by Gamow and his colleagues in 1948. In 1990, at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society, 1,500 scientists in the audience burst into a sudden, thunderous standing ovation when they saw the COBE results placed on a view graph, showing a near-perfect agreement with a microwave background with a temperature of 2.728 K. The Princeton astronomer Jeremiah P. Ostreicher remarked, "When fossils were found in the rocks, it made the origin of species absolutely clear-cut. Well, COBE found the universe's fossils." However, the view graphs from COBE were quite fuzzy. For example, scientists wanted to analyze hot spots or fluctuations within the cosmic background radiation, fluctuations that should be about a degree across in the sky. But COBE's instruments could only detect fluctuations that were 7 or more degrees across. They weren't sensitive enough to detect these small hot spots. Scientists were forced to wait for the results of the WMAP satellite, due to be launched after the turn of the century, which they hoped would settle a host of such questions and mysteries. Chapter 4. Inflation and Parallel Universes. Nothing cannot come from nothing. Lucretius. I assume that our universe did indeed appear from nowhere about 10^10 years ago. I offer the modest proposal that our universe is simply one of those things which happens from time to time. Edward Tryon. The universe is the ultimate free lunch. Alan Guth. In the classic science fiction novel Tau Zero, written by Paul Anderson, a starship named Leonora Christine is launched on a mission to reach the nearby stars. Carrying 50 people, the ship can attain velocities near the speed of light as it travels to a new star system. More important, the ship uses a principle of special relativity, which says that time slows down inside the starship the faster it moves. Hence, a trip to the nearby stars that takes decades, as viewed from Earth, appears to last only a few years to the astronauts. To an observer on Earth watching the astronauts by telescope, it would appear as if they were frozen in time, so that they are in a kind of suspended animation. But to the astronauts on board, time progresses normally. When the ship decelerates and the astronauts disembark on a new world, they will find that they have traveled 30 light-years in just a few years. The ship is an engineering marvel. It is powered by ramjet fusion engines that scoop the hydrogen out of deep space and then burn it for unlimited energy. It travels so fast that the crew can even see the Doppler shifting of starlight. Stars in front of them appear bluish, while stars behind them appear reddish. Then disaster strikes. About 10 light-years from Earth, the ship experiences turbulence as it passes through an interstellar dust cloud, and its deceleration mechanism becomes permanently disabled. The horrified crew find themselves trapped on a runaway starship, speeding faster and faster as it approaches the speed of light. They watch helplessly as the out-of-control ship passes entire star systems in a matter of minutes. Within a year, the starship zips through half the Milky Way galaxy. As it accelerates beyond control, it speeds past galaxies in a matter of months, even as millions of years have passed on Earth. Soon, they are traveling so close to the speed of light, tau zero, that they witness cosmic events, as the universe itself begins to age before their eyes. Eventually, they see that the original expansion of the universe is reversing, and that the universe is contracting on itself. Temperatures begin to rise dramatically as they realize that they are headed for the big crunch. Crew members silently say their prayers as temperatures skyrocket, galaxies begin to coalesce, and a cosmic primordial atom forms before them. Death by incineration, it appears, is inevitable. Their only hope is that matter will collapse into a finite area of finite density, and that, traveling at their great speed, they might slip rapidly through it. Miraculously, their shielding protects them as they fly through the primordial atom, and they find themselves witnessing the creation of a new universe. As the universe re-expands, they are awed to witness the creation of new stars and galaxies before their eyes. They fix their spacecraft and carefully chart their course for a galaxy old enough to have the higher elements that will make life possible. Eventually, they locate a planet that can harbor life and create a colony on that planet to start humanity all over again. This story was written in 1967, when a vigorous debate raged among astronomers as to the ultimate fate of the universe, whether it would die in a big crunch or a big freeze, would oscillate indefinitely, or would live forever in a steady state. Since then, the debate seems to be settled, and a new theory called inflation has emerged. Birth of Inflation. Spectacular realization, Alan Guth wrote in his diary in 1979. He felt exhilarated, realizing that he might have stumbled across one of the great ideas of cosmology. Guth had made the first major revision to the Big Bang theory in 50 years by making a seminal observation. He could solve some of the deepest riddles of cosmology if he assumed that the universe underwent a turbocharged hyperinflation at the instant of its birth, astronomically faster than the one believed by most physicists. With this hyperexpansion, he found that he could effortlessly solve a host of deep cosmological questions that had defied explanation. It was an idea that would come to revolutionize cosmology. Recent cosmological data, including the results of the WMAP satellite, are consistent with its predictions. It is not the only cosmological theory, but is by far the simplest and most credible. It is remarkable that such a simple idea could solve so many thorny cosmological questions. One of several problems that inflation elegantly solved was the flatness problem. Astronomical data has shown that the curvature of the universe is remarkably close to zero, in fact, much closer to zero than previously believed by most astronomers. This could be explained if the universe, like a balloon that is rapidly being inflated, was flattened out during the inflation period. We, like ants walking on the surface of a balloon, are simply too small to observe the tiny curvature of the balloon. Inflation has stretched space-time so much that it appears flat. What was also historic about Guth's discovery was that it represented the application of elementary particle physics, which involves analyzing the tiniest particles found in nature, to cosmology, the study of the universe in its entirety, including its origin. We now realize that the deepest mysteries of the universe cannot be solved without the physics of the extremely small, the world of the quantum theory and elementary particle physics. Search for unification. Guth was born in 1947 in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Unlike Einstein, Gamow, or Hoyle, there was no instrument or seminal moment that propelled him into the world of physics. Neither of his parents graduated from college or showed much interest in science. But by his own admission, he was always fascinated by the relationship between math and the laws of nature. At MIT in the 1960s, he seriously considered a career in elementary particle physics. In particular, he was fascinated by the excitement generated by a new revolution sweeping through physics, the search for the unification of all fundamental forces. For ages, the holy grail of physics has been to search for unifying themes that can explain the complexities of the universe in the simplest, most coherent fashion. Since the time of the Greeks, scientists have thought that the universe we see today represents the broken, shattered remnants of a greater simplicity, and our goal is to reveal this unification. After 2,000 years of investigation into the nature of matter and energy, physicists have determined that just four fundamental forces drive the universe. Scientists have tried to look for a possible fifth force, but so far all results in this direction have been negative or inconclusive. The first force is gravity, which holds the sun together and guides planets in their celestial orbits in the solar system. If gravity were suddenly turned off, the stars in the heavens would explode, Earth would disintegrate, and we would all be flung into outer space at about 1,000 miles an hour. The second great force is electromagnetism, the force that lights up our cities, fills our world with TV, cell phones, radio, laser beams, and the internet. If the electromagnetic force were suddenly shut down, civilization would be instantly hurled a century or two into the past, into darkness and silence. This was graphically illustrated by the great blackout of 2003, which paralyzed the entire Northeast. If we examine the electromagnetic force microscopically, we see that it is actually made of tiny particles, or quanta, called photons. The third force is the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactive decay. Because the weak force is not strong enough to hold the nucleus of the atom together, it allows the nucleus to break up, or decay. Nuclear medicine in hospitals relies heavily on the nuclear force. The weak force also helps to heat up the center of Earth via radioactive materials, which drive the immense power of volcanoes. The weak force, in turn, is based on the interactions of electrons and neutrinos, ghost-like particles that are nearly massless and can pass through trillions of miles of solid lead without interacting with anything. These electrons and neutrinos interact by exchanging other particles, called W and Z bosons. The strong nuclear force holds the nuclei of the atoms together. Without the nuclear force, the nuclei would all disintegrate, atoms would fall apart, and reality as we know it would dissolve. The strong nuclear force is responsible for the approximately 100 elements we see filling up the universe. Together, the weak and strong nuclear forces are responsible for the light emanating from stars via Einstein's equation E equals mc squared. Without the nuclear force, the entire universe would be darkened, plunging the temperature on Earth and freezing the oceans solid. The astonishing feature of these four forces is that they are entirely different from each other, with different strengths and properties. For example, gravity is by far the weakest of the four forces, 10 to the 36th power times weaker than the electromagnetic force. The Earth weighs 6 trillion trillion kilograms, yet its massive weight and its gravity can easily be cancelled by the electromagnetic force. Your comb, for example, can pick up tiny pieces of paper via static electricity, thereby cancelling the gravity of the entire Earth. Also, gravity is strictly attractive. The electromagnetic force can be both attractive or repulsive, depending on the charge of a particle. Unification at the Big Bang. One of the fundamental questions facing physics is, why should the universe be ruled by four distinct forces? And why should these four forces look so dissimilar, with different strengths, different interactions, and different physics? Einstein was the first to embark upon a campaign to unify these forces into a single, comprehensive theory, starting by uniting gravity with the electromagnetic force. He failed because he was too far ahead of his time. Too little was known about the strong force to make a realistic unified field theory. But Einstein's pioneering work opened the eyes of the physics world to the possibility of a theory of everything. The goal of a unified field theory seemed utterly hopeless in the 1950s, especially when elementary particle physics was in total chaos, with atom smashers blasting nuclei apart to find the elementary constituents of matter, only to find hundreds more particles streaming out of the experiments. Elementary particle physics became a contradiction in terms, a cosmic joke. The Greeks thought that as we broke down a substance to its basic building blocks, things would get simpler. The opposite happened. Physicists struggled to find enough letters in the Greek alphabet to label these particles. J. Robert Oppenheimer joked that the Nobel Prize in Physics should go to the physicist who did not discover a new particle that year. Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg began to wonder whether the human mind was even capable of solving the secret of the nuclear force. This bedlam of confusion, however, was somewhat tamed in the early 1960s when Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig of Caltech proposed the idea of quarks, the constituents that make up the protons and neutrons. According to quark theory, three quarks make up a proton or a neutron, and a quark and antiquark make up a meson, a particle that holds the nucleus together. This was only a partial solution, since today we are flooded with different types of quarks, but it did serve to inject new energy into a once dormant field. In 1967, a stunning breakthrough was made by physicists Steven Weinberg and Abdus Salam, who showed that it was possible to unify the weak and electromagnetic forces. They created a new theory whereby electrons and neutrinos, which are called leptons, interacted with each other by exchanging new particles called the W and Z bosons, as well as photons. By treating the W and Z bosons and photons on the very same footing, they created a theory which unified the two forces. In 1979, Steven Weinberg, Sheldon Glashow, and Abdus Salam were awarded the Nobel Prize for their collective work in unifying two of the four forces, the electromagnetic force with the weak force, and providing insight into the strong nuclear force. In the 1970s, physicists analyzed the data coming from the particle accelerator at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, which fired intense beams of electrons at a target in order to probe deep into the interior of the proton. They found that the strong nuclear force that held the quarks together inside the proton could be explained by introducing new particles called gluons, which are the quanta of the strong nuclear force. The binding force holding the proton together could be explained by the exchange of gluons between the constituent quarks. This led to a new theory of the strong nuclear force called quantum chromodynamics. So, by the mid-1970s, it was possible to splice three of the four forces together, excluding gravity, to get what is called the Standard Model, a theory of quarks, electrons, and neutrinos, which interact by exchanging gluons, W and Z bosons, and photons. It is the culmination of decades of painfully slow research in particle physics. At present, the Standard Model fits all the experimental data concerning particle physics, without exception. Although the Standard Model is one of the most successful physical theories of all time, it is remarkably ugly. It is hard to believe that nature, at a fundamental level, can operate on a theory that seems so cobbled together. For example, there are 19 arbitrary parameters in the theory that are simply put in by hand, without any rhyme or reason. That is, the various masses and interaction strengths are not determined by the theory, but have to be determined by experiment. Ideally, in a true unified theory, these constants would be determined by the theory itself, without relying on outside experiments. Furthermore, there are three exact copies of elementary particles, called generations. It is hard to believe that nature, at its most fundamental level, would include three exact copies of subatomic particles. Except for the masses of these particles, these generations are duplicates of each other. For example, the carbon copies of the electron include the muon, which weighs 200 times more than the electron, and the tau particle, which weighs 3,500 times more. And last, the Standard Model makes no mention of gravity, although gravity is perhaps the most pervasive force in the universe. Because the Standard Model, notwithstanding its stunning experimental successes, seems so contrived, physicists tried to develop yet another theory, or the Grand Unified Theory, GUT, which put the quarks and leptons on the same footing. It also treated the gluon, the W and Z boson, and the photon on the same level. It could not be the final theory, however, because gravity was still conspicuously left out. It was considered too difficult to merge with the other forces, as we shall see. This program of unification, in turn, introduced a new paradigm to cosmology. The idea was simple and elegant. At the instant of the Big Bang, all four fundamental forces were unified into a single coherent force, a mysterious superforce. All four forces had the same strength and were part of a larger, coherent whole. The universe started out in a state of perfection. However, as the universe began to expand and cool rapidly, the original superforce began to crack, with different forces breaking off one after the other. According to this theory, the cooling of the universe after the Big Bang is analogous to the freezing of water. When water is in liquid form, it is quite uniform and smooth. However, when it freezes, millions of tiny ice crystals form inside. When liquid water is totally frozen, its original uniformity is quite broken, with the ice containing cracks, bubbles, and crystals. In other words, today we see that the universe is horribly broken. It is not uniform or symmetrical at all, but consists of jagged mountain ranges, volcanoes, hurricanes, rocky asteroids, and exploding stars, without any coherent unity. Moreover, we also see the four fundamental forces without any relationship to each other. But the reason why the universe is so broken is that it is quite old and cold. Although the universe started in a state of perfect unity, Today it has gone through many phase transitions, or changes of state, with the forces of the universe breaking free of the others, one by one, as it cooled. It is the job of physicists to go backward, to reconstruct the steps by which the universe originally started in a state of perfection, and which led to the broken universe we see around us. The key, therefore, is to understand precisely how these phase transitions occurred at the beginning of the universe, which physicists call spontaneous breaking. Whether it is the melting of ice, the boiling of water, the creation of rain clouds, or the cooling of the Big Bang, phase transitions can connect two entirely different phases of matter. To illustrate how powerful these phase transitions can be, the artist Bob Miller has asked the riddle, "How would you suspend 500,000 pounds of water in the air with no visible means of support?" The answer, build a cloud. False vacuum. When one force breaks off from the other forces, the process can be compared to the breaking of a dam. Rivers flow downhill because water flows in the direction of the lowest energy, which is sea level. The lowest energy state is called a vacuum. However, there is an unusual state called the false vacuum. If we dam a river, for example, the dam appears to be stable, but it is actually under tremendous pressure. If a tiny crack occurs in the dam, the pressure can suddenly burst the dam and release a torrent of energy from the false vacuum, the dammed river, and cause a catastrophic flood toward the true vacuum, sea level. Entire villages can be flooded if we have spontaneous breaking of the dam and a sudden transition to the true vacuum. Similarly, in gut theory, the universe originally started out in the state of the false vacuum, with the three forces unified into a single force. However, the theory was unstable, and the theory spontaneously broke and made the transition from the false vacuum, where the forces were unified, to the true vacuum, where the forces are broken. This was already known before Guth began to analyze gut theory. But Guth noticed something that had been overlooked by others. In the state of the false vacuum, the universe expands exponentially, just the way De Sitter predicted back in 1917. It is the cosmological constant, the energy of the false vacuum, that drives the universe to expand at such an enormous rate. Guth asked himself a fateful question. Can this exponential De Sitter expansion solve some of the problems of cosmology? Monopole problem. One prediction of many gut theories was the production of copious numbers of monopoles at the beginning of time. A monopole is a single magnetic north or south pole. In nature, these poles are always found in pairs. If you take a magnet, you invariably find both a north pole and a south pole bound together. If you take a hammer and split a magnet in half, then you do not find two monopoles. Instead, you find two smaller magnets, each with its own pair of north and south poles. The problem, however, was that scientists, after centuries of experiments, had found no conclusive evidence for monopoles. Since no one had ever seen a monopole, Guth was puzzled why gut theories predicted so many of them. Like the unicorn, the monopole has continued to fascinate the human mind despite the absence of confirmed observations, Guth remarked. Then it suddenly hit him. In a flash, all the pieces fit together. He realized that if the universe started in a state of false vacuum, it could expand exponentially, as De Sitter had proposed decades earlier. In this false vacuum state, the universe could suddenly inflate by an incredible amount, thereby diluting the density of monopoles. If scientists had never seen a monopole before, it was only because monopoles were spread out over a universe that was much larger than previously thought. To Guth, this revelation was a source of amazement and joy. Such a simple observation could explain the monopole problem in a single stroke. but Guth realized that this prediction would have cosmological implications far beyond his original idea. Flatness problem. Guth realized that his theory solved another problem, the flatness problem discussed earlier. The standard picture of the Big Bang could not explain why the universe was so flat. In the 1970s, it was believed that the matter density in the universe, called omega, was around 0.1. The fact that this was relatively close to the critical density of 1.0 so many billions of years after the Big Bang was deeply disturbing. As the universe expanded, omega should have changed with time. This number was uncomfortably close to the value of 1.0, which describes a perfectly flat space. For any reasonable value of omega at the beginning of time, Einstein's equations show that it should almost be zero today. For omega to be so close to one, so many billions of years after the Big Bang, would require a miracle. This is what is called in cosmology the fine-tuning problem. God, or some creator, had to choose the value of omega to within fantastic accuracy for omega to be about 0.1 today. For omega to be between 0.1 and 10 today, it means that omega had to be 1.00000000000000001 second after the Big Bang. In other words, at the beginning of time, the value of omega had to be chosen to equal the number 1 to within 1 part in 100 trillion. Which is difficult to comprehend. Think of trying to balance a pencil vertically on its tip. No matter how we try to balance the pencil, it usually falls down. In fact, it requires a fine tuning of great precision to start the pencil balanced just right so it doesn't fall over. Now try to balance the pencil on its tip so that it stays vertical, not just for 1 second, but for years. You see the enormous fine-tuning that is involved to get omega to be 0.1 today. The slightest error in fine-tuning omega would have created omega vastly different from 1. So why is omega so close to 1 today, when by rights it should be astronomically different? To Guth, the answer was obvious. The universe simply inflated by such a remarkable degree that it flattened the universe. Like a person concluding that Earth is flat because he cannot see the horizon, astronomers concluded that omega is around 1 because inflation flattened the universe. Horizon problem. Not only did inflation explain the data supporting the flatness of the universe, it also solved the horizon problem. This problem is based on the simple realization that the night sky seems to be relatively uniform, no matter where you look. If you turn your head 180 degrees, you observe that the universe is uniform, even though you have just seen parts of the universe separated by tens of billions of light years. Powerful telescopes scanning the heavens can find no appreciable deviation from this uniformity either. Our space satellites have shown that the cosmic microwave radiation is also extremely uniform. No matter where we look in space, the temperature of the background radiation deviates no more than 1/1000 of a degree. But this is a problem, because the speed of light is the ultimate speed limit in the universe. There is no way in the lifetime of the universe that light or information could have traveled from one part of the night sky to the other side. For example, if we look at the microwave radiation in one direction, it has traveled over 13 billion years since the Big Bang. If we turn our heads around and look in the opposite direction, we see microwave radiation that is identical, that has also traveled over 13 billion years. Since they are at the same temperature, they must have been in thermal contact at the beginning of time. But there is no way that information could have traveled from opposite points in the night sky, separated by over 26 billion light years since the Big Bang. The situation is even worse if we look at the sky 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the background radiation was first formed. If we look in opposite points in the sky, we see that the background radiation is nearly uniform. But according to calculations from the Big Bang theory, these opposite points are separated by 90 million light years because of the expansion of space since the explosion. But there is no way that light could have traveled by 90 million light years in just 380,000 years. Information would have had to travel much faster than the speed of light, which is impossible. By rights, the universe should appear quite lumpy, with one part too distant to have made contact with another distant part. How can the universe appear so uniform when light simply did not have enough time to mix and spread information from one distant part of the universe to the other? Princeton physicist Robert Dicke called this the horizon problem, since the horizon is the farthest point you can see, the farthest point that light can travel. But Guth realized that inflation was the key to explain this problem as well. He reasoned that our visible universe was probably a tiny patch in the original fireball. The patch itself was uniform in density and temperature. But inflation suddenly expanded this tiny patch of uniform matter by a factor of 10 to the 50th power, much faster than the speed of light, so that the visible universe today is remarkably uniform. So the reason why the night sky and the microwave radiation is so uniform is that the visible universe was once a tiny but uniform patch of the original fireball that suddenly inflated to become the universe. Reaction to inflation. Although Guth was confident the inflationary idea was correct, he was a bit nervous when he first began to give talks publicly. When he presented his theory in 1980, I was still worried that some consequence of theory might be spectacularly wrong. There was also the fear that I would reveal my status as a greenhorn cosmologist, he confessed. But his theory was so elegant and powerful that physicists around the world immediately saw its importance. Nobel laureate Murray Gell-Mann exclaimed, "You've solved the most important problem in cosmology." Nobel laureate Sheldon Glashow confided to Guth that Steven Weinberg was furious when he heard about inflation. Anxiously, Guth asked, "Did Steve have any objections to it?" Glashow replied, "No, he just didn't think of it himself." How could they have missed such a simple solution, scientists asked themselves. The reception to Guth's theory was enthusiastic among theoretical physicists, who were amazed at its scope. It also had an impact on Guth's job prospects. One day, because of the tight job market, he was staring unemployment in the face. "I was in a marginal situation on the job market," he confessed. Suddenly, job offers began to pour in from top universities, but not from his first choice, MIT. But then he read a fortune cookie that said, "An exciting opportunity lies just ahead of you if you are not too timid." This gave him the nerve to boldly phone MIT and inquire about a job. He was stunned when MIT called a few days later and offered him a professorship. The next fortune cookie he read said, "You should not act on the impulse of the moment." Ignoring its advice, he decided to accept the MIT position. What would a Chinese fortune cookie know anyhow? He asked himself. However, there were still serious problems. The astronomers were less than impressed by Guth's theory, since it was glaringly deficient in one area. It gave the wrong prediction for Omega. The fact that Omega was roughly close to 1 could be explained by inflation. However, inflation went much further and predicted that Omega, or Omega plus Lambda, should be precisely 1.0, corresponding to a flat universe. In the following years, as more and more experimental data were collected, locating vast amounts of dark matter in the universe, Omega budged slightly, rising to 0.3. But this was still potentially fatal for inflation. Although inflation would generate over 3,000 papers in the next decade among physicists, it continued to be a curiosity for astronomers. To them, the data seemed to rule out inflation. Some astronomers complained privately that particle physicists were so obsessed with the beauty of inflation that they were willing to ignore experimental fact. Astronomer Robert Kirshner of Harvard wrote, "This inflation idea sounds crazy. The fact that it is taken seriously by people who sit firmly in endowed chairs doesn't automatically make it right." Roger Penrose of Oxford called inflation a fashion the high-energy physicists have visited on the cosmologists. Even aardvarks think their offspring are beautiful. Guth believed that sooner or later the data would show that the universe was flat. But what did bother him was that his original picture suffered from a small but crucial defect, one that is still not completely understood today. Inflation was ideally suited to solving a series of deep cosmological problems. The problem was he didn't know how to turn inflation off. Think of heating up a pot of water to its boiling point. Just before it boils, it is momentarily in the state of high energy. It wants to boil, but it can't because it needs some impurity to start a bubble. But once a bubble starts, it quickly enters a lower energy state of the true vacuum, and the pot becomes full of bubbles. Eventually, the bubbles become so large that they coalesce until the pot is uniformly full of steam. When all the bubbles merge, the phase of transition from water to steam is complete. In Guth's original picture, each bubble represented a piece of our universe that was inflating out of the vacuum. But when Guth did this calculation, he found that the bubbles did not coalesce properly, leaving the universe incredibly lumpy. In other words, his theory left the pot full of steam bubbles that never quite merged to become a uniform pot of steam. Guth's vat of boiling water never seemed to settle down to the universe of today. In 1981, Andrei Linde of the P.N. Lebedev Institute in Russia and Paul J. Steinhardt and Andreas Albrecht, then at the University of Pennsylvania, found a way around this puzzle, realizing that if a single bubble of false vacuum inflated long enough, it would eventually fill up the entire pot and create a uniform universe. In other words, our entire world could be the byproduct of a single bubble that inflated to fill up the universe. You did not need a large number of bubbles to coalesce in order to create a uniform pot of steam. Just a single bubble would do if it inflated long enough. Think back to the analogy of the dam and the false vacuum. The thicker the dam, the longer it takes for water to tunnel through the dam. If the wall of the dam is thick enough, then the tunneling will be delayed arbitrarily long. If the universe is allowed to inflate by a factor of 10 to the 50th power, then a single bubble has enough time to solve the horizon, flatness, and monopole problem. In other words, if tunneling is sufficiently delayed, the universe inflates long enough to flatten the universe and dilute the monopoles. But this still leaves the question, what mechanism can prolong inflation that huge amount? Eventually, this sticky problem became known as the graceful exit problem. That is, how to inflate the universe long enough so that a single bubble can create the entire universe. Over the years, at least 50 different mechanisms have been proposed to solve the graceful exit problem. This is a deceptively difficult problem. I've tried several solutions myself. It was relatively easy to generate a modest amount of inflation in the early universe, but what is extremely difficult is getting the universe to inflate by a factor of 10 to the 50th power. Of course, one might simply put in this 10 to the 50th power factor by hand, but this is artificial and contrived. In other words, the process of inflation was widely believed to have solved the monopole, horizon, and flatness problems, but no one knew precisely what drove inflation and what shut it off. Chaotic inflation and parallel universes. Physicist André Linde, for one, was unfazed by the fact that no one agreed on a solution to the graceful exit problem. Linde confessed, "I just had the feeling that it was impossible for God not to use such a good possibility."